Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, good day, good evening, wherever you are on this wonderful planet of ours. I'm delighted you're able to join us. Human beings go through all kinds of experiences. If you are a person that is engaged in social services of any type, a minister, a counselor, it doesn't make any difference. When you are serving people in a way and manner where you become aware of the challenges that they have faced, it really has a deep effect on you. Victoria Mavis is my guest this evening. This woman is very accomplished. She is a speaker, an author herself, and a human resource expert. She herself had an accident at a very young age and is considered to have a disability. She's owned her own business. She's been employed by private end of industry and just been in so many different working environments. Her education is extensive, and she has really dedicated her life to working with people that have disabilities, various educational institutions, healthcare providers, because she wants the people that are considered disabled to realize that they can have a life of their own, an independent life of their own. Victoria, I want to welcome you to the program.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's my honor to be here with you tonight.
Well, it's really a pleasure. Your book, Every Scar, tells a story, I think, is a very profound title, because that is true. Any scars, mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, that one has, there's always a story that goes along with those scars. And on the front of your book, there are pictures of two absolutely adorable little girls. And when I started reading your book, I said, wow, this really gives an inside view into what a person that has had a disability occur when they previously were considered normal and healthy, and an accident changes everything, creating a disability, and it's something that has to be contended with throughout one's life. This is something that was very profound. You and Angelo Senesi decided to put this book together. And it is written in a fictitious format, but there is so much emotion in this book. There is so much insight into this book. This is something that for both of you, there had to be something very special that motivated the two of you to come together to put together Every Scar Tells a Story. How did you and Angelo get together?
Well, it's a great question. So if I rewind, our journey of writing the book started 10 years ago.
Oh, my.
But the story itself started, I hate to say 50 years ago, but it started when I had an accident when I was 4 years old. And, you know, through my life, I've had to deal with the outcome of that, which is a physical walking disability. And, you know, as a kid and a young adult, I never considered myself having a disability. I mean, I know I walk funny and I'd be labeled that way, but I tried not to let it stand in my way. So fast forward, well, about 15 years or so ago, I was in, with some classes with some folks, and they kept on saying, like, what happened? And when I would tell my story, they're like, you gotta tell your story. And I'm like, no, I can't tell my story. And then, Professor Angelo is actually a friend of mine. And I approached him when I thought I wanted to write it and said, hey, Ange, would you be willing to help me? You know, and that's what started the book. So when we look at it, and I appreciate you picking up on the pictures on the front of the book, that's actually my sister and I.
Oh, my goodness.
Who two of the characters are based off of. And so even though it is a fictitious book, probably 98.5% represents things that happened in my life at one time or another.
Mm-hmm. What I found so, I'll say deeply moving, is that the dialogue with the different persons, the different characters in the book, and the openness about communicating what it is like when you're made fun of, when you don't know all of whatever needs to be known, and there are people that do know, but abandonment, all kinds of feelings come in. And I thought the way that the book was put together was just really absolutely wonderful. And Rhonda is someone that when she comes into the book right at the beginning, and there's the other character, Liz. And Rhonda is a therapist, and I thought it was fascinating the interaction between Rhonda, the therapist, and Liz, who was going through all kinds of challenges. And Liz, at the time she teams up with Rhonda, ends up teaming up with her because of a suggestion by a man by the name of Justin. And each of these individuals represent an aspect of human experience. And with each of them, those experiences went so deep that each of these characters really had to come to terms with that which they were either ignoring or they didn't know anything about. This is quite a read.
Yeah. Thank you. When you mentioned those other two, the best supporting characters, you know, we talked often about, as we wrote the chapters and the words, we talked often about the fact that, you know, my disability is obvious. You can't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people who are held back by things that you and I will never see, whether that's medical, emotional, mental, whatever it is. And so I think Justin and Rhonda probably represent more of those people that have some of those issues that on the surface you never see that they have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yet when you say the dialogue forces it, I mean, it was painful as a writer. And this is the writing part of it. As a writer, it was painful to write the words because Angelo kept on saying, you got to tell me what happened. You have to tell me what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he kept on pressing for not just the words, but how to feel, what came out of this thing, you know, that kind of thing. And had it not been for that partnership, I don't know that we could have recaptured that. Because some of those feelings and thoughts and resentments and, you know, tears were buried so deeply. I remember we were like 2 years in, and I came up with something, and he looked at me and goes, you never told me that before.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I couldn't talk about it myself.
Mm-hmm. This is something I think just about every human being has, those parts of themselves, especially if they went through trauma, like, you know, as children many times will. And it can be from the viciousness of, you know, a playmate. It can be from the thoughtlessness of family, or the, as you portrayed, there's a generational difference in the way things are handled. And the mother character, which is a very, very strong character, but she had a certain disposition. She had gone through a great deal of difficulty herself. So there's this understanding that human beings are human beings, and that's all through the book. And I think that that is so powerful, because I don't know of anybody that hasn't been wounded. Have you ever met anybody that hasn't? I haven't.
No, I used to say, and that's probably... kind of my mindset. I would look at people that looked what I call normal, And I'd say, why can't my life be like theirs? Their life is so simple. And then, you know, I realized, yeah, that's not the truth. You know, again, mine are physical. You know, my challenge. And so when we look at, when I look at some of the other characters and some of the people I've met along the way, once I hear their story, it's like, oh my gosh, my life wasn't that bad after all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had loving people who raised me. We may have had our differences. We may have not maybe communicated like I would today. But I was loved and given a loving home and, you know, those kind of things that some people never get.
Rhonda, the character that you have here as the therapist, I was so fascinated with the perspective of her story because her demons, if you will, dealt with marrying someone that she did not love, but yeah, who was very, very wealthy and ended up, and the terminology was she'd become her husband's handmaid. And she had never, even though she was a therapist, had never really had that integrity with herself. And yeah, one of the aspects that I really liked about this story is how Rhonda came to terms with her own unwillingness to face the realities of her own choices, and that she couldn't blame anybody else for those choices.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. I think a lot of people look to somebody else to blame. Liz did. I mean, she did for years. It may not have been a person, but she blamed the things she didn't get on her leg.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get this because I'm disabled. I didn't get the job. I didn't get the guy. I didn't get whatever it was. Heaven forbid, the parking space. You know, I joke about that, but she blamed. She didn't see it. Her character, i.e. me, you know, didn't see it until later in life. I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't blame anyone, but I blamed a thing, which is just as bad. And once I learned to take responsibility for my part in the thing, the accident, the recovery, the, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, my life changed on a dime from being felt like I was the victim to now I'm the victor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got to choose.
Mm-hmm. And that's another aspect. And the story has a lot of twists and turns to it. But that is one of the positionings that the character Liz really has to have integrity with. And there is this comment by Rhonda that she uses the term hairballs. Well, we all, if we know anything about cats, we're familiar with that. But she said she considered, and this is the therapist, considering hairballs to be thoughts or feelings you can't or won't express. But if you don't, they'll have a damaging effect on your life, just like it has on a cat's life. If the cat doesn't cough up the hairball, it can create serious problems. And what that was it goes so deep many times that it's very difficult to bring it into the light, to bring it out where those hairballs, if you will, are going to just utterly come apart, dissolve, and disappear. And there are so many conditions of health that are affected by our emotions, and more research comes out about that. But I think it's been known for a long time that those hairballs, if you will, or we might want to call them demons, but sometimes stuff is buried so deeply, and this is what happened with Liz. It took a lot. And there was a class she went to that had to do with the visioning, becoming acquainted with yourself and maybe becoming aware of secrets that you really, honestly have buried for so long. You had to regurgitate a lot of old stuff. And this is what is in the book, and it's a fascinating read because Liz had to come face-to-face with things. Now, the irony was that Rhonda had done this process. She actually was a teacher for this process. But it hadn't had the same effect on her as it did on Liz. And I thought, that's the difference in people. Everybody will deal with certain scenarios in their own way. As you were writing this and you have the different characters who have their challenges, learning to speak up, speak out, what was that like for you?
I don't want to say the heaviness around it, but the challenge for me personally was to not get sucked into my head and my interpretation of what that meant and make a judgment right or wrong. You know, I'll be the first one to tell you, you know, as a human being, it's easy to judge, and I've judged plenty of people. As people, you know, as we started writing the story and started putting some of that in, I initially found myself making a right or wrong judgment on them. I'm like, no, you can't do that. This story is a story. You know, and how do we get their experience to help somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
And that really was the goal of writing the book in the first place. I don't, you know, and this is not a secret. It's just something. I don't have children. And so, you know, when I was sitting here thinking about writing the book, or, you know, it's like, gosh, when I'm no longer here, what legacy do I have? Really? And then when I started thinking about writing the book, I thought, I want that legacy to be a story, not of pity, not of, oh my, but a story that changes people to be able to empower them in their whole own life, in their decisions, to help other people, to, you know, even if you come away with a one, aha, I never thought about that before. That was the goal of the book.
And I think you definitely have achieved it, and it gives so many different angles of thought and the perceptions by different people and how when secrets are kept, that relationships between people will disintegrate sometimes. There will be anger. There will be pettiness, jealousy. There's all kinds of things that the human can go through. The human character is extraordinarily diverse. And the two sisters that are, Liz is one of them, the primary characters in the book, how because there wasn't that openness and there was fear about the accident that occurred, there was so much that was left unsaid and unresolved for years. And when it finally did come out, it was amazingly liberating for all parties concerned.
Yeah. You know, I guess I liken it to the saying, the truth shall set you free. It really is. You know, is, you know, you talk about the secrets, say, let's not tell mom, or, you know, let's the little packs of what we will or won't say, but I believe there's amazing power in being transparent with your feelings, your thoughts, your processes, but still you and I don't have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to be respectful during the process. You know, and when you talk about the girls and, you know, their pack, I call it the pack, but the way they lived their lives for years until they said, oh, my gosh, you know. And so, like, every Scar tells a story, really opened up, the title of the book opened up a couple of years ago when I had a new hairdresser. And she goes, pulls my hair back, and she sees the scar from the middle of my forehead down almost to my ear. And she goes, oh, my mom, you know, she kind of said it. And it's like I'm page 323 or something. But she says, my mom always says, you know, every scar tells a story, what's yours? Mm-hmm. And I realized in that moment, I had worked for years, for decades, to hide that scar. Because I didn't want to talk about it. You know, now it's just another conversation. I need. I moved back to Michigan, you know, after living outside of the state for 31 years. And, you know, people walk up to me and they say the same thing. They said that for the last, you know, 40 plus years. What happened? I'm like, well, I had an accident. You know, I give them the short version and then we move on.
Mm-hmm.
And now the conversations are more like, how can I help you? Mm-hmm. And that how can I help you for me had to be, I had to be willing to accept help. And I had somebody over that stopped over the other night, and, you know, usually I would pop up and get something from the refrigerator to eat or to drink. And they said, well, can, they're walking through the, my condo, and they go by, and they said, do you want a glass, some water? And they go, yeah, sure. And they said, oh, can I get it myself? And I would have always said no. Mm-hmm. It's like, sure, you can get it. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't happen.
Isn't it amazing when you reflect on this? And when you and Angelo are writing out all of these different aspects of challenge, the challenges, I should say, that we accept, usually we're the ones that put the script into our lives where we think nobody else has ever gone through anything like we've gone through.
Right.
And yeah, there's that do-it-yourself syndrome, and if you can't do it, then you suck it up. That's the way it goes. And that's really pretty sad, because I find, I don't, and I'm sure you do too, that people, when they understand why something is the way it is, they're very thoughtful. They're not demeaning, yeah, at least that's been my observation. But if you walk around with a chip on your shoulder, they're going to say, fat chance. I'm afraid to say anything, because if I say something, I'm going to be shredded.
Right, right. No, they're absolutely right. And it's, you know, and I think it, I can see for how I generated that by closure, whether it was body language, whether it was words, whether it was a dirty look I gave you, you know, I fostered that. I fed that monster, mm-hmm. You know, now I can see how, gosh, I could have done that so differently.
Mm-hmm. I think that has happened with so many people. They feel that if they are seen as weak because of a physical injury, or, you know, maybe you have an emotional injury where you've never been able to tell anybody about something, or maybe there's questions you have and you just are begging for answers, but you're afraid to open your mouth because you might be judged by somebody. And the truth is, there are some schmucks in life that are going to have their bitterness coming out of their mouth, or their biases, or their bigotry, whatever word you want to use. But I think, really, overall, they're in a minority. And maybe people will think what I'm saying is being Pollyannish, but we really have to ask ourselves, if we let people know that we can use help, yet show that we're willing to not be the victim, be the victor, as you so aptly said, it makes a difference, and they have respect for you, and they want to see you achieve.
Yeah. Being in human resources as long as I have, I always tell people this. I think people want a couple of things. From my perspective as an HR professional, one, they want to be appreciated. Everyone wants to be appreciated. But they really want to be a contribution. They want to help and be of service to people. And sometimes they just don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think, you know, and I think this is one of the things that's in the book. I put the phrase about, do I need you to carry a cup, you know, my cup of coffee so I don't spill? Well, maybe I don't, but gosh, it'd be easier on me. And if it allowed you to be of service, is there anything wrong with that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a mentor many years ago, and there was a very intense lesson that I went through. And one of the things that she said is, you need to remember, it's just as important to learn how to receive as it is to give.
Yeah.
And her point was that I examine how I felt when I gave. And, of course, that was just a very positive feeling for me. She said, allow others to give, too. Don't deny them that same kind of joy and feeling. It's something that's very difficult to learn, because I think we're indoctrinated that it's best to do it ourselves. And sometimes We need to be smart enough to make it okay to let everybody, somebody else do it that's actually going to be doing it better than us.
Sure. Sure. I look at one of the things in the book, it talks about Liz's, or I go back to my childhood, but Liz's childhood where she fell in the middle of the, forget if it was the sidewalk or the road, and her mom, you know, she can't get up. And her mom tells her, just get up, you know, rub off your knees and keep going. And, you know, people may see that as being rude, but it gave Liz what she needed to always go get over her hurdles and her obstacles. You know, now, could it have been said a little differently? Yeah, maybe, you know, but it you know, worked. And I look at things like that and think there's that we have a choice on how we react to that. You know, that was a moment in time in 1967 when people and the way they expressed things were so differently than today.
Very true. You know, very true.
You know, and people didn't express feelings back then. You know, Liz talks about her dad feeling responsible for accident, but he never talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have those conversations back then. I didn't have the conversation with my mom about how I feel picked on. In fact, one of my best friends as a child read the book and, you know, texted me afterwards and said, you never told me what you went through in high school. I was your best friend. Why didn't you talk to me about it? And I'm like, we just didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now I feel very differently, and that's why I also look at helping people take the stories and lessons from it. Hey, the world's not like it was when you and I grew up. You know, and people are still people, however, are much more open to communication and the way we treat people.
You have a wonderful paragraph in your book where Rhonda is telling Liz, the choice is yours. Freedom and peace come by embracing your limitations, commanding the power of all of your talents. You can continue to blame your leg for all of your misfortune and remain a victim. However, you didn't survive at the age of 4 to be that. Your life was destined for a greater purpose. Ours all are. At the end of each day, the choice is yours. Victim or victor, choose. And those words right there, I think, are extraordinarily powerful because that is what freedom really is. There's not a government that can give it to you. You're the only one that can give it to yourself. And it's a lesson that takes many of us a long time to learn.
Yeah.
It's not an easy journey, is it?
No, absolutely not. And you know, I think along with that, had it not been for Rhonda, you know, kicking, you know, giving Liz fits to kick and scream and challenging, that never would have been a realization. But since that day, I really look at life to say, choose.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do have your own website, Victoria, and it's victoriamavis.com, and Mavis is spelled M like Mary, A, V like Victor, I, S. What are people going to find on your website?
Well, they're going to find the book, of course. They're going to find, you know, I do blog. I tell a little bit about who Victoria really is. Some people know, you know, it's something, I would say it's something to write a book or not, but if you don't understand where I grew up from, you have less of an appreciation, I think, for the story.
Mm-hmm.
But it tries to explain the author and why we chose to write the book. When I was writing it, I had a lot of people that said, well, why don't you just write afterwards, like how you got through situations. I'm like, no, if you don't understand all the feelings that went into it, how can we write the remedies?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're going to find on the website. I also Twitter, I Facebook. I've got a lot of, I do a lot of timely stuff, you know, out in social media, like, okay, here's what I saw, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. You know, here's what I saw and here's how I'm reacting. Or I ask other people that, what's your reaction?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might have a different insight than I do. I only know it from my perspective.
Absolutely true. Victoria Mavis, it's been a delight having you as a guest. This book is an extraordinarily powerful read. Every scar tells a story. They can go to your website, victoriamavis.com, and find out more. Thank you for being with me this evening.
Hey, thank you. It was absolutely a pleasure and my honor, Donna. Take care.
Thank you. Donna Sebo here, and we are going to be taking a break. We'll be coming back. I am in studio, and the telephone number here in studio is 253-582-5597. If you would like to chat, I'm here if you would like to do exactly that. We're going to be back in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Tomorrow evening, we are going to be talking about a very, very significant case. This is going to step back in time a little bit. It's the case of the murderous Dr. Cream, and Dean Jobe has done a phenomenal job of research on it. I think you'll find the conversation a very interesting one. Then, remember, Wednesdays are always a doubleheader? Yes, well, in the first hour, which is going to be Warriors for Peace from 7 to 8 p.m., we're going to be talking with Robert Conde, and Evil Shall Be Vanquished. Now, the reason that is the title is that Robert collected the writings of his son, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2018. His son is just a very special person, and he did a lot of writing. He's a magnificent writer. His father kept all of the writings that he received and has put them in a book. And this is a open batch of information that this young man left as a legacy that can be inspiring to just about anyone. And, of course, then following is the Donna Sebo Show, and we're going to be talking with Scott Creighton out of England about the Great Pyramid Void Enigma. Ah, yes. Archaeologists have found something within the pyramid that was not expected at all. After all of these years, when they thought they knew just about everything about the greatest pyramid that has gotten the most amount of publicity. Pyramids are all over this planet, by the way. Well, we're going to find out more about that. And then we're going to be talking, I think, with Marie Pisano. And this is her book, From Barefoot to Stilettos. And the reason I said maybe is that she is in Tennessee. And, of course, we know that they're having horrible, horrible floods back there. And I have not been able to reach her. And we'll see what happens, but she may or may not be able to make that interview. Then we're going to be talking with Eric Wargo about precognitive dream work. Have you ever had dreams that have come true? I have. So that and more is coming up on the programs. And again, don't forget, if you like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, then my assistant, Deb, posts things about the guests that are coming up on the shows. And then you have a firsthand view of these wonderful people that are contributing so much to the betterment of our world. I think that's what is so marvelous about a book. Not only do you hold it in your hand, but there is that essence with a book that it's like a friend that never gets old. It is never going to get tired. And whenever you need to be inspired, that magnificent piece of publication is always there to do exactly that. 253-582-5597 is the number to call into. If you would like to chat, all I need is your first name or your initial, and then we'll take it from there. Well, just when you think you've heard about everything that possibly could be invented, you never, ever will, because someone is always going to come up with some idea. We human beings are extraordinarily innovative. And when I heard about the Sensoria Smart Socks, I said, seriously, are you serious about this? Do you know one pair of these socks costs $199? Ouch. Well, this is why they're so expensive. They have a dock for a microelectronic chip that wirelessly relays data about your cadence, pace, heart rate, and more. This goes into an app that's on your phone, your smartphone, or maybe to your computer. Well, if you're going to have high-tech socks, what about high-tech shoes? Now, what in the world is going to be different about a pair of tennis rompers, tennis shoes, whatever term you want to use? I mean, they're just shoes, for heaven's sakes. You lace them up and you're off and running. Well, there are shoes that you can buy. They're called high-tech tennis shoes. $400 a pair. Why are they $400 a pair? They lace themselves. And apparently, all you have to do is stick your foot into the sneaker, the tennis shoe, whatever you want to call it. And there are digital sensors inside the shoe that will deduce your foot size and automatically close around it. Okay. What do they do when the soles of the shoes wear out? Can you ever wash them? They don't say anything about that. $400 for a pair of these shoes? Well, apparently, Nike, who created them, they're called the Adapt BB 2.0. They were primarily designed for athletes, and there is an NBA star in the Memphis Grizzlies who actually paid for those shoes. Well, I'm sure with his salary, that's okay. But $400? I wear them out in 1 month, for heaven's sakes. Goodness gracious. That would be unbelievable. Well, if you have nothing else to do with your money, I guess that is perfectly all right. And, you know, speaking of tennis shoes, you know, you have to have shoes that are comfortable on your feet whenever you do a lot of walking. And if you're like so many of us, and I raise my hand to be one of them, you try to get in 10,000 steps a day. Well, it's not quite 5 miles, but it's getting close. So you're exercising, you're climbing stairs, you're walking, you're doing whatever you do. Well, with one woman, her name is Debbie, she has a Fitbit. And she said her Fitbit just had stopped working, so she was really uptight over that. She wasn't going to get any credit for all of the steps that she took. So she had a Zumba class, and that would really pile up the steps really quickly. Well, her husband, when he heard about it, he said, I will be happy to give you my Fitbit because I really need the exercise. Yep. Okay, That is one sharp hubby. He doesn't have to work out, but she gets to do it for him. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't work in my house. I don't know about yours, but it's one of those things. You got to do it yourself. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Now, if you are someone that loves cookies and you really like to make them, I was going through some of my cookbooks, and I came across a recipe that I have saved, and it's been in my recipe collection for years, and it came out of Sunset Magazine. I'm going to share it with you. These are what you would call monster cookies. They are huge. And I remember whenever there'd be a church, you know, raffle or something that they were trying to raise money, these oversized cookies just sold like hotcakes. And it really is great. So if you are going to be doing any of these events where, you know, it could be a garage sale, it could be, a church raffle of some kind, or you're trying to raise money for a school or what have you, this is a fun recipe to have. And you need to be sure that you have baking pans that are at least 2 inches shorter and narrower than your oven. And for me, it's the pans that are like half sheet pans. They're great. And two of these cookies, this is how big they are. Two cookies will fit on a 12 by 15 inch pan. Three will fit on a 14 by 17 inch pan. And you can bake two pans at a time, placing them in the top and bottom thirds of the oven. But fundraising events, these are great. And I've got four different flavors. And, you know, we're coming in to the time of year where there's Halloween. People are getting together for certain things. Yes, there are people getting together. And you can mask or not mask, but they're getting together. And then we've got Thanksgiving. And then we've got the holidays. Well, so many of the fundraising events take place during this time of the year. And people come up with the most delicious goodies. Now, this is what you are going to need. And this is the basic recipe, and then I'll share with you what you can do for adaptations. But you need to know that when you measure this cookie dough out, you're going to be using a half cup measure, and you will level the dough off and turn out onto a greased cookie sheet, and spacing the cookies at least 6 inches apart and 2.5 inches from the pan edge. And you're going to need a pie pan, because there's something you need to do so that that cookie is flattened into a 5.5 inch circle. I told you they were big, and then they spread out even more when they bake. All right, so this is an oatmeal chocolate chip cookie, and you're going to take 1 cup of butter and 1.5 cups of brown sugar, firmly packed, and you're going to beat that together. Of course, the butter has to be at room temperature. You're going to beat it until it is nice and creamy with the sugar. Then you add 2 eggs and a teaspoon of vanilla. I usually like to add a little bit more vanilla. That's just me. Then you're going to add 1.5 cups of whole wheat or all-purpose flour. Does not need to be sifted. You're going to add 2 1/3 cups of rolled oats, regular or quick cooking, doesn't make any difference. 2 teaspoons of baking soda, 1 teaspoon of salt. You're going to mix all of this until it's well blended. Using an electric mixer, it's just great. And then you're going to add 1 12-ounce package of semi-sweet chocolate. You can use white chocolate. You could have a mixture, but you need 12 ounces of those chocolate chips or butterscotch chips. You can mix them. And then 1.5 cups of chopped nuts. This is a big amount of dough. And again, you're going to need to measure that dough out to half cup, level off. And I'll tell you, if you spray the cup with nonstick cooking spray before you put the dough in, the dough just comes right out. It's just wonderful. And remember, you're only going to have 3 on a 14 by 17 inch baking pan. Now, that pie plate that I told you about, you need to know that you grease the bottom of the pie plate and then what you're going to do is dip that pie plate into sugar and use that pie plate to flatten each one of your cookies into the 5.5-inch circle. And, you know, if it's not smoothing out the way you like, then you can use your fingers if you want. You're going to bake the cookies in a 350-degree oven about 15 minutes. The edges of the cookie will get a little bit brown, and you then need to let it cool once you take the pan out of the oven for about 5 minutes and then put it on racks, the cookies, remove them. I like to use parchment sheets. I really do. I think that it makes cleanup and transferring the cookies to your racks so much easier. And then the cleanup is just a whiz. So I like to use parchment sheets whenever I bake cookies. Now, that recipe that I gave you is a basic recipe. If you want to alter the flavor a little bit, you can add a teaspoon of ground cinnamon and a half a teaspoon of ground nutmeg. Mix those seasonings into the flour itself. And you can use raisins if you didn't want to use the chocolate. Or craisins. You know, whatever is your preference. A little bit of imagination, you can transform these cookies. And if you would like to have peanut butter flavored, then each, you know, your 1 cup of butter, and then you add a cup of your chunky peanut butter with the 2 cups of the brown sugar, blending it, you know, very, very well, then beating in your eggs, and add 2.5 cups of all-purpose flour. You don't sift it. 1.5 teaspoons of soda and 1 teaspoon of baking powder. Mix it until they're well blended, and you can stir in a cup of chopped salted peanuts if you want. If you don't want the peanuts in it, that's fine. That's up to you. And just, you know, follow the instructions using the pie plate with a little bit of the sugar on the bottom, and you can use the fork tines to make that cross patch pattern if you like. And they may bake a little bit more quickly, so keep an eye on them, but it might only take about 13, 14 minutes until they are done. It is going to make 10 or 11 of those cookies. So, you know, these are just wonderful. And people will go, wow. So as a fundraiser, or even just to give away to the kids in the neighborhood or whatever you feel like doing, these monster cookies are just absolutely fabulous. And, you know, if you're a parent or you're a baker that says, I want to be sure that whatever I have is going to be good and nutritious, well, you can always add things like wheat bran or, you know, some other items that you would like to put in there that are going to increase the nutritional value of the cookie. It's up to you. But the most important thing is that it's unique. They're large. And like I said, I've had this recipe for years, and I came across it as I was getting ready for the program today. And I thought, okay, I'll share it with you. The temps are getting cooler here in the Pacific Northwest. We have absolutely gorgeous weather. It's in the 70s, and we are really enjoying it, but you can smell fall. Fall has started early, I think, for us, and I'm really looking forward to it, as I know many, many people are. So we have been very, very fortunate with this beautiful weather. Well, what if you had a passion about collecting something? Well, I'm not that big of a collector, but I have my collection of items that I love, that I've enjoyed through the years due to the enthusiasm and support of friends primarily. But I think it would really be something to deal with the challenge when you had 5 million plus items that you had collected. I'm not kidding. There are people that are that passionate about collecting. And you know what? There's a guy by the name of Val Shively. And when I found out about him and I saw the photos of his record collections that he started when he was 12 years old, it is amazing. Floor to ceiling records. He has a building that he keeps it in. And he's got a friend that knows where every single section of records He knows exactly what it represents, who it's all about. And, I mean, I don't know how I could even live with 5 million of records and that type of thing. But, you know, it's people like that that have a passion for collecting that preserve history. And this gentleman started off collecting 45s because when he was growing up, that was really the thing. He collected original publications, and I just was absolutely amazed at how extensive this man's collection is. There, it's just all of the rock and roll, you know, the famous stars, all kinds of groups. And it has been with all ethnicities, you know, through the years. Do you know how he got a lot of his 5 million plus? The vinyl records, 4 million of those, maybe more than 4 million, are the 7-inch 45 RPM singles. He got them when jukebox companies went bankrupt. Radio stations, record companies, record stores, the plants that actually pressed out the records, distributors, individual collectors. This man hates computers. Absolutely hates them. And his business is selling these phenomenal recordings, and it is amazing what he's collected with African American music and so many different aspects. But he has literally been a one-man museum of music in the United States. And he said it's just phenomenal. And I just think when I look at it, all of these covers, all of these records, and I want to sneeze. I think of all the dust that would be there. But by golly, he sells this through mail order records out of his home. But this is his passion. This is what he's done. And apparently the Library of Congress is going to try to buy his collection from him. Because he doesn't have anybody he's going to leave it to. And his very good friend, who has been with him for years, he said he's going to have to take it and put it somewhere because the day's going to come when he's not going to be around to continue the collecting. But it is just phenomenal. Can you imagine 5 million items as a collector? Mm-hmm. Well, if you're married, I don't think your spouse is going to be too happy with it. Just an incredible story. It's a true story. And it is something that I just look at and say, gee, I'm very grateful for people like that that collect because of them. Many aspects of history are preserved. Without them, you wouldn't have the history. And boy, has he got it when it comes to the world of music. You know, speaking of a collection, maybe at this time, as I know it has been with many, many people, including myself, we look at, and I think because of being in the lockdown over the time that we've been in that lockdown, and we look around and say, do we need certain things? And when Goodwill opened up here, and a lot of other organizations like St. Vincent de Paul and the Salvation Army, people are saying, oh, it's time to get rid of stuff. And so that's what they're doing. They're decluttering. We've had so many garage sales in my neighborhood that I am amazed at the amount of people that are interested in them. You'd think they'd get tired of going to all these different sales, but it's amazing. Everybody has something, and it might just suit you perfectly when you go. So this is the time of the year for garage sales. And it's time to let go of certain things, and I think this is a good time to do it. And there were some comments that were made to an individual. They said, how can I get rid of old tax returns, and how long should I keep them? I've got all of this paper stuff. And this is what they were advised, and I was told you should keep your tax records for at least 7 years, especially if you're in business for yourself. But keeping them for 3 years after you filed is usually long enough, and unless you're somebody that hasn't filed. And there are some people who should keep them forever, and you can go to irs.gov and find out how long you should keep your records. And then old tax information, they give you information on how to dispose of it, what you need to do. And there's all kinds of protocols that you can follow. And then when you're getting ready to let things go, sometimes it's a good idea to have a friend to assist you with it. I know that it's hard because you'll have memories about certain things. You go, gee whiz, maybe I should, I'll keep this. Maybe my kids would want it, etc. Lots of times people find out their kids didn't want it at all. I heard a story last night that really surprised me. A friend of mine, I was in a meeting, and he was talking about how he had this beautiful golden toned silk jacket that he had found, and it was at a yard sale someplace where he got it. He said it cost him less than a dollar, and it was just really gorgeous. He was an actor, and he would use it sometimes with some of the performances that he was in. And he took it in to an antique place, and the person asked him, do you know what you have here? And he said, what do you mean? It's just an old jacket. And the person said, no, this was made in the 1600s. They could tell from the way the silk was structured in the jacket, its age. And he said, I ended up getting paid $500 for it. I thought, that's an interesting story. Well, how many times have you watched the Antique Roadshow? People don't realize what they have. Maybe they've inherited something or they saw something they like, just like my friend. Got it for a dollar, $2, $3, and it ends up being worth a small fortune. Well, that is something that doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, it's quite exceptional, and that happened with my friend. But I will tell you, sometimes getting rid of clutter, you need somebody other than yourself to help you. And if you have a bag for junk that's to go in the trash, or a bag for, let's say, Goodwill, Salvation Army, St. Vincent de Paul, you have a bag for that. And then you have your I Want to Keep It stack. And when someone is there to help you, that you'll end up be able to go through it pretty quickly. And then if you're smart, you let them take it, if necessary, to whatever charity organization you'd like to give it to. And anything, the comment was made that anything that would cost $20 or less or take 20 minutes or less to replace, it's okay to get rid of. Or maybe you have some friends that could use it. But there's always a way of handling the decluttering. And I think it's a good thing. I really, really do. And it takes time. And you do have to think about things, but it really does work. I had a friend after he got married. He was a hoarder. And his wife, after they were married, went down to the task of taking care of one room after another. And he said he just didn't want to watch anything because he couldn't bear to let anything go. And what she did, she told him to leave the house and she would go through one room at a time. And it took her a full year. I mean, that's how much junk he had. And what occurred is that when he'd come home, he'd see these black bags tightly closed, and he said it would took all the discipline in him to not stop and find out what she had taken out because it was put out for trash. And she reorganized everything, and he said it was absolutely wonderful, but he said he didn't dare open up one of the bags because if he did, it'd all go back into the house. But he said she was very thorough, and how she tidied things up, it really felt good. They had some breathing space. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. No matter who you are, no matter where you are, you do make a difference. Be kind to yourself and realize that you have a very, very special gift to offer life, and only you can offer it. So turn on that light inside of you, smile, and be about the business of being the best you can. God bless, be well. I'll be talking with you again tomorrow. Don't forget, it's the murderous Dr. Cream.
been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.